Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for April 10, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the lead article relates to the Michigan school shooting. Judge sentences shooter's parents. Crumblies get 10 to 15 years after their teen murdered four. The first parents convicted in a U.S. mass school shooting were sentenced to at least 10 years in prison Tuesday, as a Michigan judge lamented missed opportunities that could have prevented their teenage son from possessing a gun and killing four students in 2021. These convictions are not about poor parenting, Oakland County Judge Cheryl Matthews said. These convictions confirm repeated acts or lack of acts that could have halted an oncoming runaway train. The hearing in a crowded, tense courtroom was the climax of an extraordinary effort to make others, in addition to the 15-year-old attacker, criminally responsible for a school shooting. Jennifer and James Crumbly did not know Ethan Crumbly had a handgun in a backpack when he was dropped off at Oxford High School, but prosecutors convinced jurors the parents still played a disastrous role in the violence. The Crumblies were accused of not securing the newly purchased gun at home and acting indifferently to signs of Ethan's deteriorating mental health, especially when confronted with a chilling classroom drawing earlier the same day. The Crumblies were convicted this year of involuntary manslaughter. The blood of our children is on your hands too, Craig Schilling said during Tuesday's sentencing hearing, wearing a hoodie with the image of his son Justin Schilling on his chest. Nicole Beausoleil, the mother of shooting victim Madison Baldwin, told the Crumblies they failed at parenting. While you were purchasing a gun for your son and leaving it unlocked, said Beausoleil, one of a handful of Oxford family members who spoke in court, I was helping her finish her college essays. Prosecutor Karen McDonald asked the judge to stretch beyond the sentencing guidelines and order a minimum 10-year prison sentence. Defense attorneys sought to keep the Crumblies out of prison, noting they already spent nearly 2.5 years in jail after failing to meet a $500,000 bond following their arrest. They will get credit for that jail time and become eligible for parole after serving at least 10 years in custody. If release from prison is denied, they could be held for up to 15 years. Five deputies in the suburban Detroit courtroom stood closely over the couple, and more lined the walls. James Crumbly, 47, was recorded in jail making threats toward McDonald. Before being sentenced, he stood and insisted he did not know his son was deeply troubled. My heart is really broken for everybody involved. I have cried for you and the loss of your children more times than I can count, he said. The couple had separate trials in Oakland County Court, 40 miles north of Detroit. Jurors saw the teen's violent drawing on his school assignment and heard testimony about the crucial hours before the attack. Ethan Crumbly sketched images of a gun, a bullet, and a wounded man on a math paper, accompanied by despondent phrases. The thoughts won't stop. Help me. Blood everywhere. My life is useless. Ethan told a counselor he was sad. A grandmother died and his only friend suddenly moved away, but said the drawing only reflected his interest in creating video games. His parents were called to a hasty meeting at school that lasted less than 15 minutes. They did not mention that the gun resembled one James Crumbly had purchased just 4 days earlier, a Sig Sauer 9mm. School staff did not demand that Ethan go home, but were surprised when the Crumblies did not volunteer it. Instead, they left with a list of mental health providers and said they were returning to work. Later that day, November 30, 2021, their son pulled a handgun from his backpack and began shooting, killing Schilling, Baldwin, Tate Meyer, and Hannah St. Juliana, and wounding 7 other people. Ethan, now 17, is serving a life sentence for murder and other crimes. The Crumbleys ignored things that would have made a reasonable person feel the hair on the back of their neck stand up, the judge said. Opportunity knocked over and over again, louder and louder, and was ignored. No one answered. Jennifer Crumbley, 46, began her remarks by expressing deepest sorrow about the shooting. She also said her comment at her trial about looking back and not doing anything differently was completely misunderstood. My son did seem so normal. I didn't have a reason to do anything different, Jennifer Crumbley said. She blamed the school for not giving her the bigger picture about Ethan, sleeping in class, watching a video of a mass shooting, and writing negative thoughts about his family. The prosecution has tried to mold us into the type of parents society wants to believe are so horrible only a school or mass shooter could be bred from, Jennifer Crumbley said. We were good parents. We were the average family. During the trials, there was no testimony from specialists about Ethan's mental health, but the judge, over defense objections, allowed the jury to see excerpts from his journal. I have zero help for my mental problems, and it's causing me to shoot up the school, he wrote. I want help, but my parents don't listen to me, so I can't get any help. Also on the front page, an article entitled Democrats Lean In to Border Security in Race for Congress. Shift in strategy comes amid administration's struggles to manage influx of migrants. With immigration shaping the elections that will decide control of Congress, Democrats are trying to outflank Republicans and convince voters they can address problems at the U.S. border with Mexico, embracing an issue traditionally used against them. The shift in strategy, especially from Democrats running in battleground states, comes as the Biden administration has struggled to manage an unprecedented influx of migrants at the southwest border. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, led his party in vilifying immigrants as poisoning the blood of the country and calling for mass deportations of migrants. As the GOP looks to flip control of the Senate, they are tying Democrats to President Joe Biden's handling of immigration. The tactic already figured large in elections like Arizona's Senate race, a seat Democrats almost certainly need to win to save their majority. Republican Carrie Lake linked Republican Ruben Gallego, the likely Democratic nominee, to Biden, telling a crowd in March that there's really not a difference between the two. Democrats are no longer shrugging off such attacks. They believe they can tout their own proposals for fixing the border, especially after Trump and Republican lawmakers rejected a bipartisan proposal on border security earlier this year. It gives some Democrats an opportunity to say, look, I'm here for solutions, Gallego said. Clearly, the Republicans are here to play games. And so whether it's Carrie Lake or Donald Trump, they're not interested in border security. They're interested in the politics of border security. And we're here to actually do something about it. During most of his 5 House terms, Gallego was a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. But he quietly left the group as he prepared for a Senate run. Now he's emphasizing his work on bolstering the ranks of U.S. Customs and Border Protection and securing funding for communities impacted by recent spikes in immigration, which he calls a crisis. Standing in front of the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office in Arizona last month, Gallego slammed the GOP for blocking the bipartisan border bill. Every minute we wait means more fentanyl deaths, more strain on our first responders, and the looming possibility of street releases, something that no small community wants, he said. Democrats hope to bolster their chances of holding the Senate by pulling off a difficult feat, flipping a long-held GOP seat in Texas, by fielding Democratic Representative Colin Allred against incumbent Republican Ted Cruz. Allred emphasized his connection to border communities on the campaign trail and recounted how he made childhood visits to Brownsville, Texas, where his grandfather worked as a customs officer. "Our border communities are not just political backdrops, not just places you go to point out problems," he said at a news conference last month. "They're places where real people live, where they're trying to raise their families." Allred and Gallego joined a House task force focused on border security. Some Senate Democrats also recently leaned into legislation focused on immigration enforcement. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee launched ads criticizing GOP senators for opposing the bipartisan Senate deal. "It's all a part of a strategy to neutralize the GOP's advantage on the issue by convincing swing voters that Democrats are serious about border policy. Democrats aren't going to win on immigration this year, but they have to get closer to a draw on the issue to get to a place where people take them seriously," said Lanai Erickson, a senior vice president at Third Way, a centrist Democratic think tank. "Be palatable enough on that issue that people are then willing to consider other priorities." Still, Democrats face a difficult task. A new poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found that almost half of adults blame Biden and congressional Democrats for the current situation at the U.S.-Mexico border, while 41% blame Republicans in Congress. Republicans are using practically every tool in Congress to denounce Biden's handling of the southern border. They are forcing Democrats to take tough votes on border security measures and demanding policy changes in return for aiding Ukraine. In February, the House impeached Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas for his handling of the southern border. "The reason you're seeing the Democrats talk about the border is because they have a political crisis, not because they're trying to solve the border crisis," said Senator Steve Daines, chair of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. "If they truly want to solve the border crisis, President Biden can go back to the Oval Office with a stroke of a pen and can make significant inroads in solving this problem, but he chooses not to." Republicans lost several Senate elections in 2022, including in Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Nevada, after Trump-backed candidates struggled to raise money and connect with a broader, more moderate range of voters during the general election. This year, as Republicans look to win Senate seats in West Virginia, Montana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, they are uniting around border policy changes. They are also bringing up past comments and votes from Gallego and Allred, as well as vulnerable senators. In Texas, one political action committee aligned with Cruz launched an ad attacking Allred for calling the border wall racist in 2018. According to an analysis by media tracking firm Ad Impact, over $26 million was spent in February on TV ads about the border and immigration in federal and down-ballot races in Texas, Arizona, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Ohio by candidates, political groups, and other groups. And now on page 2, we find an article about the eclipse entitled, "So You Viewed the Eclipse Without Safety Glasses." Despite warnings, online searches for related phrases spike. If you looked at the eclipse without your special safety glasses, you're not alone. Searches for phrases like "my eyes hurt" and "I looked at the eclipse without glasses" spiked following the eclipse. So despite warnings and advice from experts, it looks like plenty of folks snuck an unprotected peek. For most people, they probably looked for a few seconds and looked away after, either because it hurt or because they knew it was a bad idea, said Sunir Garg, a physician and co-director of the Retina Research Program at Wills Eye Hospital. Looking at the sun's rays can harm your eyes and damage your macula, a part of the retina that helps give you clear vision when looking straight ahead. During the eclipse, the sun may have been easier to look at because it was partially covered by the moon, which could lead to damage to some viewers' unprotected eyes. Luckily, sort of, you'll probably know right away if you damaged your eyes, Garg said. Symptoms such as blurry, wavy, or distorted vision, or spots in your vision when blinking, are likely to appear immediately. But don't panic right away. It's likely that those symptoms could fade in the coming hours or days, and your vision may go back to normal. If, after several days, your central vision remains distorted or wavy, you should see an ophthalmologist for further treatment. If you are experiencing symptoms, Garg suggests doing a check of your vision at home and monitoring how it progresses. To do so, cover each eye by itself to check the vision of the other eye by looking at something with fine detail, such as a newspaper or your phone. That way, you can make sure each eye by itself is doing okay, Garg said, and you may find a problem in one eye and not the other. Unlike with a bum knee or elbow, it can be difficult to tell which eye may be giving you trouble, Garg said. Issues with your macula typically don't result in pain, even if they're badly damaged. And when it comes to sight, your brain will typically pick and choose the clear parts of each eye and combine those clear images together to make the best possible picture. Even if your eyes are fine, Garg said, it's important to see a doctor, an eye doctor, regularly. Whether you looked at the eclipse unprotected or not, especially if you are over 40, many eye conditions like glaucoma or macular degeneration won't necessarily have symptoms. Seeing an ophthalmologist yearly can detect those changes easily, Garg said. And now on to page 3 in National and World News. Lead article on page 3 is entitled, Trump Has Another Loss. Former president tried to delay beginning of Monday criminal trial. A New York appeals court judge Tuesday rejected Donald Trump's latest attempt to delay his hush money criminal trial, taking just 12 minutes to swat aside an argument that it should be postponed while the former president fights a gag order. Justice Cynthia Kern's ruling was the second time in as many days the state's mid-level appeals court refused to postpone the trial, scheduled to begin next week, further narrowing any plausible path to the delay that Trump's legal team repeatedly sought. Trump's lawyers wanted the trial delayed until a full panel of appellate court judges could hear arguments on lifting or modifying a gag order that bans him from making public statements about jurors, witnesses, and others connected to the hush money case. They argue the gag order is an unconstitutional limit on the presumptive Republican nominee's free speech rights while he campaigns for president and fights criminal charges. The First Amendment harms arising from this gag order right now are irreparable, Trump lawyer Emil Bove said at an emergency hearing Tuesday in the state's mid-level appeals court. Bove argued Trump shouldn't be muzzled, while critics, including his former lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen and porn actor Stormy Daniels, assail him. Both are key prosecution witnesses. Bove also argued the order unconstitutionally restricts Trump's critiques of the case, and with them, his ability to speak to the voting public and its right to hear from him. Stephen Wu, the appellate chief for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, countered that there is a public interest in protecting the integrity of the trial. What we are talking about here is the defendant's uncontested history of making inflammatory, denigrating comments about people involved in the case, Wu said, This is not political debate. These are insults. Wu said prosecutors already had trouble getting some witnesses to testify because they know that their names in the press may lead to. They know what their names in the press may lead to. Wu didn't identify the witnesses, but noted they included people who would testify about record-keeping practice. The gag order still affords Trump free rein to talk about a host of issues, noting that he can comment on Judge Juan M. Mershon and District Attorney Alvin Bragg and raise political arguments as he sees fit. Trump has repeatedly lambasted Bragg, a Democrat, and the judge. Barring further court action, jury selection will begin on Monday. And now an article from the Senate Armed Services Committee. Lawmakers question U.S. support. Austin tells Congress Israel is taking steps to boost aid to Gaza. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin told Congress on Tuesday that pressure on Israel to improve the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza appears to be working, but he said more must be done, and it remains to be seen if the improvement will continue. It clearly had an effect. We have seen changes in behavior, and we have seen more humanitarian assistance being pushed into Gaza, Austin said in a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing. Hopefully, that trend will continue. Protesters interrupted the session several times by shouting at Austin to stop sending weapons to Israel. Stop the genocide, they said, as they lifted their hands stained in red in the air. A number of senators also decried the civilian casualties, saying the administration needs to do more to press Israel to protect the Gaza Strip's population of 2.3 million. Austin said he spoke with his Israeli counterpart, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, on Monday, and that he repeated U.S. insistence that Israel must move civilians out of combat zones in Gaza and properly care for them. Austin and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Charles Brown Jr. testified on Capitol Hill about the Pentagon's $850 billion budget for 2025, but the hearing offered the first chance for lawmakers on both sides to question the Pentagon's top civilian and military leadership on the administration's Israel strategy following the Israeli military's deadly strike on World Central Kitchen humanitarian aid workers in Gaza. That strike led to a shift in tone from President Joe Biden on how Israel must protect civilian life in Gaza and drove dozens of House Democrats, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to call on Biden to halt weapons transfers to Israel. Half the population of Gaza is starving and on the brink of famine due to Israel's blockades. Israel, in recent days, took initial steps to increase the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. In a call Friday, Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that future U.S. support for the war in Gaza depends on Israel taking more action to protect civilians and aid workers. At the hearing, Austin also said the military is moving ahead with plans to build a pier off the Gaza coast to increase the delivery of humanitarian aid. Next, we have an article entitled New EPA Rule Aims to Reduce Toxic Emissions. Regulations will affect 218 facilities, updates decades-old guidance. More than 200 chemical plants nationwide will be required to reduce toxic emissions that are likely to cause cancer under a new rule issued Tuesday by the Environmental Protection Agency. Administration officials said the rule advances President Joe Biden's commitment to environmental justice by delivering health protections for communities burdened by industrial pollution from dangerous chemicals. Areas that will benefit from the new rule include majority black neighborhoods outside New Orleans that EPA Administrator Michael Regan visited as part of his 2021 Journey to Justice tour. We promise to listen to folks that are suffering from pollution and act to protect them, he said. Today we deliver on that promise with strong final standards to slash pollution, reduce cancer risk, and ensure cleaner air for nearby communities. The rule will apply to 218 facilities spread across the United States, more than half in Texas or Louisiana. The action updates several regulations on chemical plant emissions that have not been tightened in almost two decades. And now an article entitled Arizona Can Enforce Abortion Law from 1864. Regulation predates statehood, would ban almost all procedures. Arizona can soon enforce a long dormant law criminalizing all abortions except when a mother's life is at stake, the state Supreme Court ruled on Tuesday, opening the door to prosecuting doctors who perform the procedures. Under the decision, a law that predates Arizona's statehood would take effect. It provides no exceptions for rape or incest, but allows abortions if a mother's life is in danger. Enforcement can take effect in 14 days. The ruling suggests doctors can be prosecuted for performing the procedure, but the majority ruling doesn't explicitly say that. The 1864 law carries a sentence of 2 to 5 years in prison for doctors or anyone else who assists in an abortion. Arizona's high court ruling reviewed a 2022 decision by the State Court of Appeals that said doctors couldn't be charged for performing the procedure in the first 15 weeks of pregnancy. Currently, 14 states are enforcing bans on abortion at all stages of pregnancy, with limited exceptions. Two states ban the procedure once cardiac activity can be detected, which is about 6 weeks into pregnancy, and often before women realize they are pregnant. And now a couple of digest articles. Norfolk Southern agreed on Tuesday to pay $600 million in a class action lawsuit settlement for a fiery February 2023 train derailment in Ohio. But residents worry the money won't go far enough to cover future health needs and won't amount to much when divvied up. Dozens of the freight train's 149 cars derailed near East Palestine. Several spilled hazardous materials that caught fire. 3 days later, officials, fearing an explosion, blew open 5 cars filled with vinyl chloride and burned the toxic chemical, sending smoke into the air. Some 1,500 to 2,000 residents were evacuated. The deal, which still needs court approval, doesn't constitute admission of liability, wrongdoing, or fault. It represents only a small slice of the $3 billion in revenue the road company generated in the first 3 months of this year. And finally, a pair to pay $1.25 million in robocalls settlement. Two conservative political operatives who orchestrated a robocall campaign to dissuade black people from voting in the 2020 election agreed to pay up to $125 million under a settlement with New York State Attorney General Letitia James, said on Tuesday. Jacob Wohl and Jack Berkman were accused of making robocalls to phone numbers in predominantly black neighborhoods in Ohio, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, and Illinois, that told people they could be subjected to arrest, debt collection, and forced vaccination if they voted by mail. Prosecutors said the robocalls went out to about 85,000 people across the U.S. Wohl and Berkman pleaded guilty to felony telecommunications fraud in Ohio in 2022. They were sued in New York in 2020 by a civil rights organization, the National Coalition on Black Civil Participation, along with people who received the calls and the state attorney general. And that does it for today's reading of the Globe Gazette for April 10, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. We will turn now to a reading of The Messenger. And now, welcome to the reading of The Messenger for April 10, 2024. On the front page, the biggest headline goes with an article entitled Erosion Repair Contract Awarded. Riverbank damage north of Fort Dodge caused by the 2019 flooding of the Des Moines River will be repaired this summer. Webster County Board of Supervisors on Tuesday approved a roughly $1 million contract to do the repairs. County Engineer Jamie Joel previously reported that the Federal Emergency Management Agency will pay 70% of the costs. The work will be done along National Avenue between the northern city limits of Fort Dodge and 170th Street. The project will include emergency erosion repair, stabilizing the riverbank on the east side of the river, and removing and replacing any part of the National Avenue pavement affected by flooding damage. The work is to be done by October 25. The Board of Supervisors on Tuesday hired Peterson Contractors, Inc. of Rhinebeck to do the job at a cost of $1,070,422.50. Supervisor Nick Carlson was absent from the otherwise unanimous vote to award the contract. Other bidders for the job were JR Corp. Mount Air, $1,122,306.50, C.J. Moyna and Sons from Elkader, $1,704,278, United Contractors from Johnston, $1,615,680, and Wiedemann Inc. from Dow's, $1,949,585. Also on Tuesday, the board accepted a $393,600 grant from the State Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship for a water quality project at Meyer Memorial Marsh. That marsh is along Lizard Creek at the border with Calhoun County. The work is to be done by June 30, 2026. Details of the project are still being developed. It will be a really nice addition to that area, as well as for the water quality of Lizard Creek, which is a priority area for us, said Matt Cosgrove, director of Webster County Conservation. Also on the front page, an article entitled, Local Group Takes Priorities Projects to D.C. When Fort Dodge leaders met with federal officials in the nation's capital on Tuesday, the topics of discussion ranged from educating former prison inmates to maintaining airline service. Representatives of Fort Dodge, Webster County, the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance, and Iowa Central Community College are in Washington, D.C. for an annual lobbying trip. The trip enables the local officials to explain projects and priorities to members of Congress and staffers from various federal agencies. The local delegation traveled to Washington on Monday. Small group meetings were held Tuesday with the Department of Justice and Federal Aviation Administration, among other agencies. Today, the group will meet with Republican U.S. Senators Joni Ernst and Charles Grassley and U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, a Republican from Hull. The group will return on Thursday. Iowa Central Priorities. Iowa Central President Jesse Ulrich and Jim Kirsten, the college's Vice President for External Relations and Government Affairs, visited the U.S. Department of Justice on Tuesday to talk about a reentry program for former prison inmates. The college has been a national leader in using a financial aid program called Second Chance Pell to help current inmates take classes. Ulrich said Tuesday that he wants to expand the college's educational offerings to inmates being reintegrated into society. The goal, he said, is to provide opportunities for them to continue their education. They really provided us with a plethora of different options to do that, he said of the federal officials. Ulrich said he plans to talk to Ernst, Grassley, and Feenstra today about the shortcomings of revised college financial aid rules. He said those rules are still a disaster for a small business owner families and farm families. The rules, he said, misrepresent the income of those families. We're going to continue to hammer that drum, he said. Fort Dodge City Council members Cameron Nelson and Megan Secor joined Rhonda Chambers, Director of Aviation at Fort Dodge Regional Airport, for a meeting with representatives of the Federal Aviation Administration. Much of the discussion was about the Essential Air Service Program, which provides subsidies to ensure that airlines continue to serve smaller communities. United Express flights to and from the local airport are provided with the support of an Essential Air Service contract. A bill to reauthorize the FAA could have a significant impact on the program, according to Chambers. As the House and Senate versions of these bills came out, I made it known to our legislators what parts of the bill, specifically the House bill, would be the beginning of the end for air service, not only in Fort Dodge, but EAS commercial airports across the nation, Chambers said. Also on the front page, an article entitled, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds Signs Law on Foreign Farmland Ownership Regulations. Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday signed into law new reporting requirements and harsher penalties related to foreign farmland ownership in Iowa. The governor signed Senate File 2204, a measure she has called for since the beginning of the 2024 legislative session. Reynolds said Iowa plays an important role in America's food chain, and when Iowa speaks on threats to American agriculture, the country listens. With this bill, our message is unmistakable, Reynolds said. American soil belongs in American hands. The law will grant the state attorney general, currently Republican Brenna Byrd, more powers on oversight relating to foreign land ownership, including the ability to subpoena foreign landowners for financial records and land purchase agreements for investigations into potential violations of foreign farmland owner restrictions. While Reynolds and Republicans have praised Iowa's strong laws restricting foreign farmland ownership, existing law limits foreign farmland purchases to 320 acres, with those who had farmland before 1980 allowed to retain their land ownership. Advocates said the measure was necessary to better identify and address potential violations on foreign farmland restrictions in Iowa. Foreign landowners would be required to provide details to the state about their land owned in other states greater than 250 acres, in addition to requiring the Iowa Secretary of State to file an annual report on foreign farmland ownership in Iowa for consideration by state officials. The law also raises fines on violations of reporting requirements. Failing to report holdings every 2 years would be up to $10,000 per violation for foreign owners, and failure to disclose leases or purchases of farmland by foreign entities would be fined up to 25% of the property's value per violation, a potentially much higher rate than the previous $2,000 fine maximum per violation. Reynolds said at the bill signing that Iowa's laws on foreign agricultural land ownership are recognized as some of the strongest in the nation, but that in the decades since these laws were first passed, countries like China have grown significantly more aggressive against the U.S., and that the purchase of American land is one strategy used by these foreign entities to gain an edge on the world stage. Our state's fertile soil and unmatched production capacity make us a natural target for this strategy, Reynolds said. Our farm families produce 10% of the nation's food supply, and Iowa ranks as America's top producer of biofuels. That makes us a natural leader in the race to stave off the evolving threat to American agriculture. Byrd praised the legislation Tuesday, saying it will give her office needed tools to protect Iowa farmland. She urged Iowans to contact her office if they have information about improper foreign ownership of farmland in the state. "Call our office. We'll investigate it," Byrd said, "and we appreciate the tools that we need to make sure that everybody is following the law." According to 2022 data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, nearly 514,000 acres of Iowa agricultural land is held by foreign investors. This represents roughly 1.6% of the state's total privately held agricultural land. The largest foreign owner of Iowa land is Canada, with almost 200,000 acres, followed by Italy, with more than 104,000 acres. China is a minor landowner in Iowa, with USDA data listing Syngenta Seeds as the only Chinese government-affiliated business owning Iowa land as of 2022, with 265 acres in Boone County. And finally, on the front page, an article entitled "House Passes Bill Adding Regulations Limits on Traffic Cameras." The Iowa House approved a bill Tuesday to regulate traffic cameras, despite criticisms from some lawmakers who said the bill unfairly limits local control, and others who said the automated traffic enforcement systems should be entirely banned. Iowa lawmakers passed House File 2681 on an 85-12 vote after approving an amendment brought forward by Representative Phil Thompson, a Republican from Boone. The amendment added some restrictions included in a similar Senate bill, including prohibition on small communities' use of cameras and requirements for use of revenue from fines. Thompson said he would like to see more restrictions on traffic cameras, but the legislation is needed now to control traffic camera use in Iowa. "While I certainly would prefer to ban these outright, the longer we sit around and do nothing on this, the more we're seeing these systems being abused across our state," Thompson said. The legislation would require local governments to receive permits from the Iowa Department of Transportation before they are able to implement automatic traffic enforcement systems. It also sets standards for fines collected on speeding violations recorded by traffic cameras. The maximum set at $500 for drivers reaching more than 30 miles per hour above the speed limit. To get a traffic camera permit from the DOT, Iowa cities and counties would have to provide the department with an explanation for why the cameras are needed at the location, including records on the number and severity of accidents, speed of drivers, and related safety concerns at the spot. The bill also would not allow tickets to be issued for speeding violations under 10 miles per hour above the speed limit. Warning signs would have to be placed between 500 and 1,000 feet before any cameras. Local governments with populations at or below 20,000 would not be allowed to use mobile traffic camera technologies to issue tickets, but could still use them to issue warnings. Cities and counties would also be required to use the funds collected from cameras for transportation infrastructure improvement or for operational costs for local police and fire departments. Some lawmakers hoped the legislation would go further. An amendment was introduced by Representative John Wills, a Republican from Spear Lake, to entirely ban traffic cameras in the state. Wills said traffic cameras are unconstitutional because they do not provide due process or give persons ticketed the right to be confronted by their accuser. These cameras are not fair, Willis said. They're not something that we should be doing, doling out justice in a way that is not fair to all our citizens in this state. Democratic Representative Sammy Sheets was among those who said traffic cameras play an important role in making Iowa roads safer. In his own community of Cedar Rapids, he said, traffic cameras have resulted in a decrease in accidents and give law enforcement an avenue to address speeding in areas where traffic stops may be dangerous. I understand the concerns by many about the traffic camera systems, Sheets said. Many cities are unfortunately abusing these systems to supplement their budgets. However, it is important to note that the evidence clearly supports the continued use of these systems as part of our commitment to safe roads. Will's amendment failed in a 47-50 vote. During subcommittee meetings on the bill, representatives of local law enforcement departments praised the bill for adding regulatory oversight to traffic camera usage in the state. But some lawmakers said on the floor that certain provisions, such as preventing smaller communities from using mobile traffic enforcement systems, could negatively impact rural police departments' ability to enforce traffic laws. The bill moves to the Senate and was referred to the Senate Ways and Means Committee for further consideration. The Senate considered another bill, Senate File 2337, earlier this session, that would have combined restrictions on traffic cameras with hands-free driving legislation. The bill was put on the, quote, unfinished business, close quote, calendars in both chambers, but no action has been taken by lawmakers since February. On page 2, we find an article entitled Mountain Goat Stuck Under Kansas City Bridge Survives Rocky Rescue. An escaped mountain goat that somehow got stuck under a Kansas City bridge has survived a rocky rescue effort and now may be reunited with the owners who suspect he was stolen from their farm 2 months ago. It's the story that captured the hearts of Kansas City, said Story Fugate of the KC Pet Project, a nonprofit that handles animal control for the city and operates shelters. Forget a solar eclipse. We were on goat watch. After Monday's eclipse, people spotted the animal, believed to be a missing goat named Chug, hopping around on the pillars that support the bridge high above the ground below. Hoping to guide it to safety, a driver managed to get a rope around the goat's neck. But that only added to the danger, Fugate said. When firefighters tried to rappel over the side of the bridge to capture the goat, he spooked and tried to jump to the next platform. But his hooves slipped and the rope caught, causing the goat to hang from his neck, not moving. Firefighters managed to undo a snag in the rope, creating slack in the line. The goat then fell as much as 15 feet to the ground, landing in a spot where crews had added padding in an attempt to soften the impact, Fugate said. A waiting veterinarian sedated the goat, and crews carried him in a sling to the top of a rocky hill, where firefighters gave him oxygen. Then he perked up and was taken for x-rays. He miraculously has no broken bones, Fugate said. The goat had been clambering along a bridge supports that are as much as 80 feet above the ground, a fall he wouldn't have survived. She said this was the latest part of the goat's adventure. He entered the shelter as a stray on March 13, was dubbed Jeffrey, and was adopted later that month, but he immediately jumped the fence at his new home, she said. Thanks to his media fame yesterday, we had somebody reach out, and they said that he is very similar to their goat that went missing back in February, she said. The family lives 2 hours away and plans to come to the shelter Wednesday to confirm that he is their stolen goat. If he is, they plan to bring Chug home with them, and the goat's adoptive owners say that is okay with them. He seems to be very particular about his living situation, Fugate said. And now the Messenger editorial, entitled Fur Ball, is Saturday at Fort Dodge Ford Toyota. It would be hard to imagine our society without pets. Dogs and cats contribute wonderfully to the happiness and well-being of people of all ages. In a perfect world, every pet would at all times be a welcome and loved part of someone's home. Unfortunately, reality falls short of that ideal. That's why it's important to our community that the Almost Home Humane Society of North Central Iowa remains strong and grows even stronger. As with so many other worthwhile endeavors, achieving laudable goals depends in part on raising the money necessary to support the cause. For the Humane Society, the Fur Ball is both an essential and fun way to generate needed funds. This year's Fur Ball will take place from 6:10 to 10 p.m. on Saturday at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota, 2723 Fifth Avenue South. This event is the biggest fundraiser for the local Humane Society. The money it generates helps pay for dog and cat food, cat litter, and medicine for the animals in the shelter. It will feature silent and live auctions with a wide array of items, a 50-50 raffle, and a pet trivia game. Food will be catered by Amigos. Individual tickets are $20 in advance and $25 at the door. People who buy four tickets can get one free. Tickets for anyone under 18 cost $10. Tickets can be purchased at the Animal Shelter, 725 South 32nd Street, or at almosthomeiowa.org. The impressive Almost Home Animal Shelter, operated by the Humane Society, helps wonderful animals in search of loving human companions find appropriate matches. It also provides a caring refuge for those animals who, for a variety of reasons, aren't immediately destined to be someone's pet. Additionally, the Humane Society undertakes an important educational mission, teaching people how to be responsible pet owners. The Fur Ball promises to be a lot of fun to benefit a great cause. Perhaps an evening at the ball will even inspire some folks to adopt a four-legged friend. We encourage everyone to go to this special event. And we will end with a brief article about Caitlin Clark. University of Iowa All-American Caitlin Clark was named the Wooden Award National Player of the Year, which is presented annually to the most outstanding women's basketball player who achieves tremendous on-court success for the second straight season. The announcement was made on Tuesday by the Los Angeles Athletic Club. Joining Clark as a finalist for the esteemed award are Cameron Brink from Stanford, Paige Buckers from the University of Connecticut, Hannah Hidalgo from Notre Dame, and Juju Watkins from USC. All five players are invited to Los Angeles for the 48th annual presentation of the Wooden Award. The Wooden Award Gala will honor the men's and women's Wooden Award winners and will include the presentation of the Wooden Award All-American teams in Los Angeles on Friday, April 12. Honorees were certified by their universities as meeting or exceeding the criteria of the Wooden Award. And that does it for today's reading of The Messenger for April 10, 2024. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
In Africa, 5-year-old Charu has no choice. She and millions like her must walk miles every day for dirty water. But together, we can end their walk by providing clean water close by. Instead of spending hours walking to get water that makes them sick, girls can be in a classroom that expands their minds, and moms will gain back time to care for their families. Sons and daughters can grow up strong, finally free of sicknesses caused by dirty water. At World Vision, care about clean water runs deep. Deep enough to reach one new person with clean water every 10 seconds. Because every child, every person, everywhere deserves clean water and the chance to rise to their full potential. It's true. When you just add water, you change a life. Learn more at worldvision.org.